Last week, Karen talked a little bit about her lived wisdom about prayer. And she partly did that in the form of some poems that she's written over the years as a way of engaging with the process of caring for her most challenging students. I'm not going to try to sum that up. For me, that was an encounter with something so distilled and complex and lovely that I just sort of don't want to mess with it. At present, our plan is to podcast at least part of that, the presentational part that Karen did. So if you missed it, you might be able to at least listen in on that once we get it posted. But here's part of my takeaway. And also, I hope one way that what Karen shared can feel connected to how I want to pick up on what we were talking about 2 weeks ago. Part of what Karen did last week was share some insight into her way of stripping away religious convention, in this particular case about prayer, and coming at it from a different perspective. She didn't call what she was describing stripping away a convention. Those are my words. But I think I'm being fair in using that description, and what I know for sure is that the resulting insights from what she described were really powerful and really lovely. And I feel so grateful for that. 2 weeks ago, I talked about how hard it is to acknowledge when some belief we hold or some system that we adhere to, perhaps some religious convention, isn't working. And it might not be working because it's got a wider sort of fatal flaw, like it's just busted from go and that's why it's not working, or it might not be working because its context has changed but the system hasn't, or they're not changing at the same rate or in the same ways, or it might be the sort of thing where there's a religious convention that's just not working for us anymore. Whatever the case is, that space where we're having that experience, that's a hard space to be in. That's a hard thing to face in the process. And part of the reason that it's hard to face is that acknowledging something isn't working confronts us with some choices. To quote the old song lyric by The Clash from the tune Should I Stay or Should I Go, it's this space where if I stay there will be trouble, if I go there will be double. You know, it's just like, it just doesn't feel like there's a happy way forward in moments like that sometimes. And so acknowledging even the possibility of the failure of a system of belief is just hard to do. That said, without that acknowledging that something isn't working, nothing changes. And we just trudge along, operating as part of keeping that broken or hollow system going. And we become part of maintaining the status quo rather than part of moving the conversation forward. So not choosing is choosing as well. We left off 2 weeks ago considering the difference between this idea of idol and idea of icon as different ways of seeing the world. And I offered a string of contrasts as what I said then and still hope would be entry points. So this is those of you that know me know that I'm leery of either ors. It doesn't tend to produce good thinking. And I presented a series of contrasts. So I really went out of my way to say these are entry points, not last words. This is not a new binary. I'm going to recap those, so I wanted to say that again. This is not a new binary. These are entry points for the consideration of something complex and multifaceted. But we sometimes need handles that are defined enough that we can grab them, or we can't really wrestle with anything. We just feel like we're sliding around in the gray all the time. When I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, I suggested that the word idol itself, in terms of language and what that language carries, it's a theological term. And a reasonable way to understand it is that it's the term for the imaginary thing that we believe will make us whole. Philosophers like to call those sorts of things in our human experience sacred objects. So that's kind of the theological take on idol. Icon, as a word, carries with it a way of holding things that draw us into an experience of wonder and awe. Very different dynamic than idol. An idol stands eternally outside of our world, and an icon is always present in our world. And I said then that one of the intriguing features of this way of thinking about the icon is that although it's present, and this is interesting because when you think about that idol always somewhere else, always outside of our world, that's distant. We can imagine a location, but it's not where we are. Icon's always present in our world, but one of the curious things about the behavior of an iconic way of looking at the world is that even though that icon is present, it doesn't abolish distance. Goodbye, binary. It doesn't abolish distance, it relocates it. And when we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, we considered how there's something in an icon that resists being fully known. But it's not because we're separated from it. It's because the mystery, the thing that we can't fully know, resides within the icon itself. So the icon is present to us, it's in our world, and it retains mystery. It doesn't abolish distance, it relocates it. It's like the icon is with us, and yet there's something about it that still has to arrive. And the thing that draws us to the icon, that attraction about which we would use a word like love, the thing that draws us to the icon keeps drawing us to it at the same time that we are unfulfilled. They're not opposites. It's not like if we got there, we'd be fulfilled, because there is a mystery. And it's more like the things that draw us don't satisfy our desire or make us whole. What they do with our desire or our lack is they make it bolder and stronger and deeper. So what grows in us, rather than this is all settled, is this is less and less settled, and that's emboldening the search. That actually is fuel for the exploration. It grows the desire. It grows the love. And as one last contrast, I suggested that when we focus on an idol, we find ourselves focused on some special object that makes everything else in the world seem mundane. But with an icon, what we focus on helps us experience the mundane as infused with special significance. And this morning, what I want to do is I especially want to circle back to that idea that an icon doesn't abolish distance so much as it relocates it. I want to suggest that something similar can happen with our hope in ways that move us into action in the world, that enliven our action in the world, that invigorate our hope. Something that most of us need on any given day. And just a little heads up, this is going to take us into some terrain that might be pretty disconcerting for some people. So as I've said many times before, the vantage point that I take in the talky bit is not here comes the revelation. It's let's get on with the exploration. This is not the last word. This is just another word. And I would say that if you encounter ideas in this exploration that feel like, you know, the shoe fits, then wear it. Keep walking. If it doesn't, then just keep on exploring. God is not going anywhere. The idea that we might get it right in some final way is absurd. So let's just relax and see if we can't enjoy the journey as much as possible. So that's where I'm coming from with this stuff. Harold Kushner, Rabbi Kushner, probably to many of us if we know him in the popular realm. Kushner is an American rabbi who, a rabbi laureate. I didn't know there was such a thing until recently, but who is probably best known for having written the book Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. A book that he wrote as a reflection well into the journey with his own son, who was diagnosed at the age of 3 with an illness that meant that he wouldn't live beyond his teen years. So someone who's wrestled deeply and personally with the question of suffering. In any case, in another context, he wrote that God's job is not to make sick people healthy. That's the doctor's job. God's job is to make sick people brave. Let me try that again. Because we could pretty much just stop there and go for a long walk and work on that one. God's job is not to make sick people healthy. That's the doctor's job. God's job is to make sick people brave. This is not an author who is theologizing or theorizing. This is an author who is suffering. It's worth remembering. There are lots of ways that we could think about a statement like that, of course, because there's lots in there. One of them is to reconsider, is to consider how it relocates hope. And I don't know about you, but when I first read that quote, I thought, now what's my job? assuming that I'm not the sick person, but someone that loves them, what's my role under that idea? Because to really cut to the chase, for me, in the system of belief that I grew up in, my religious job was to pray that God would make them healthy. But even as a kid, I could tell that there was something very confusing and challenging about that idea. And I could tell that because it didn't work. Or at least it didn't work in any kind of predictable or meaningful way, because you could pray for sick people and sometimes they got better and sometimes they stayed sick and sometimes they died. So it didn't work. And that made it confusing. And then as I got older and I started to not just observe but to think for myself, this whole idea of me praying that God would do something that would otherwise not have taken place. So that's a really important connection. This idea that if I prayed, God would do something that God otherwise would not do, started to look more and more absurd to me. And for one thing, it started to look way too small and parochial. It started to look way too local. And what I mean by that is that idea that if I pray, God will do something God otherwise would not normally do, utterly failed to explain the evening news. It didn't touch drought, it didn't touch famine, it didn't touch earthquakes and floods and mass shootings, and it just didn't work. Or to move it closer to home and more immediate in terms of the timeline, it failed to adequately account for the fact that my dad's cancer has been in park for 5 years while others have died of the same disease within weeks of their diagnosis. Stories from within this community, within this year. And it's not like there were people praying in one of those stories and not in the other. Same thing for the evening news. Listen to the soundtrack from the earthquake on the Iran-Iraq border. And in the background, you will hear people crying out to God. And for my part, trying to make the answer to that dilemma somehow be about how much faith the humans in these stories have, well, to me that sounds like something that shrinks God down to the size of my belief system. And that's a God that I just don't need. I'm just not interested. Why would I need a God like that if I have the system of belief that that God is equal to? I have my system of belief. The podcast people will be confused. The lightning missed. Let's just let them all wrestle with it. Why would I need a divinity the size of my understanding of that divinity? I'd be God in that story. And I would say that, at least for me, that's an image of God that is hazardous to believe in, because it is vulnerable in the extreme to equaling basically a pumped up version of who I wish I was, a superhuman. And if we were going to consider this idea in the context of that idol icon contrast, this is partly why I recapped it, I think that any notion of the divine that has them far away until they break into the world in an interventionist manner, that seems to me like a picture of the divine that meets the criteria of idol, like in spades. Now, that opens the entire question about whether it's a good idea to think about God as an interventionist at all. And we're going to kind of explore that bit by bit as we go. I warned you. For now, though, what I want to do is keep coming at this from the angle of relocating hope. When we move away from the idol picture of hope to the icon picture of it, what we essentially do is we uncouple it from being linked to faith in something up there, in a place that we will someday reach. We detach hope from that image. And most religious conventions about hope, the ones that many of us grew up steeped in, most conventional religious conceptions of hope approach hope as something that is safe and secure. So it's a hope in something that will come to pass. And it will come to pass with or without us. It doesn't require that conventional idea of religious idea of hope generally doesn't require our participation for it to be the case. It's going to come to pass no matter what. One of the downsides of that is that that doesn't require our active involvement. That concept of hope doesn't need us. And as a result, it can be the kind of hope that encourages passivity, because it allows us to accept our current conditions in the belief that rescue in some form or other is like just over the horizon, but it's headed our way. Kim, are you really going to suggest that there might be a problem with, you know, the hope of glory? Nope. But I am willing to suggest that there's a problem with locating that glory somewhere else. Because that kind of hope is so vulnerable to being turned into the object of our faith, into a sacred object, the thing that we think will make us whole. The kind of thing we were using the word idol for. So, how would hope behave if not in that traditional religious way? Well, for one thing, this is a familiar theme in this context. For one thing, it would not be certain. It would be risky. It would be the kind of hope that makes demands on us, that says, you want to know hope? Put your weight behind it. It's the kind of hope that tells us that we can make the world a better place, that we can transform society and enact justice, but only if we put our effort into it. A couple of weeks ago, Kim and Randall, one of the songs that they offered to us as a community was this golden oldie, you know, like from way back in the 90s. This golden oldie worship song called Did You Feel the Mountains Tremble? It's got this line in it about dancers who dance upon injustice. And I know that's a really resonant line for Kim in particular, who's a dancer, and for whom dancing and spirituality are a very fused thing. That's a pretty rich image of this conception of hope that I've been trying to describe. It is full of embodied action. It is beautiful, but it is also strenuous. It is powerful, but it is not perfect. It is intense, but it is not rigid. I mean, I could keep going. It's a very dynamic idea. A philosopher named Walter Benjamin suggests that this kind of hope is, quote, the hope that we might become the messianic answer to those before us that cried out for justice. This is an interesting idea. This kind of hope that I'm trying to describe is the hope that we might become the messianic answer to those before us that cried out for justice. And before we get stuck on the idea of us as messiahs, because that's what he just said, just remember that if you grew up evangelical, you grew up around the code language of being Jesus to others. This isn't in that code, but it's poking around that same idea. We can't bring back those that have been tortured or abused or marginalized or killed or estranged, or we could go on with the list of violences, but we might be able to help make the sort of world that they once prayed for. So just carry that and read our community time today backwards. How do the things that we prayed together about and for, How might those things ever be possible? When we start to imagine the answers, the possible answers to that question, we start to imagine how we would have to live for that to be the case. And hope gets relocated from some sure but undefensible thing somewhere else someday to the thing that we are trying to wrestle with here and now. It relocates hope. To pursue that kind of hope is to hear an answer, a call to act, and to act like the answer to the prayers that we pray and that others pray are us. If that sounds heretical to you, I refer you back to being Jesus to others. This is not a new idea. This kind of hope, iconic hope, is not just risky, it's actually unsafe. Am I overselling this? This is the kind of hope that is vulnerable to all the vicissitudes, all the contingencies, all the randomness of life. It's the kind of hope that is rooted in the earth, and like anything that is rooted in the earth, it needs to be nurtured and tended and fed and protected if we want it to grow and to bear fruit. That's what it takes. Pete Rawlins, whom you know as I'm working through these ideas, I feel very indebted to. Rawlins says this beautifully when he says, quote, "To hope is to plant our efforts in the field of risk." To hope is to plant our efforts in the field of risk. The kind of hope that I'm talking about is the kind that asks us to commit ourselves to the idea that better is possible, but not a given. Better is possible, but not a given. And that means opening ourselves as people up to the very real possibilities of disappointment and sadness and suffering and depression and like that whole continuum of things that we might broadly put in the big basket of negative in our culture. Our oldest two kids are university age. Davis just finished his undergrad work this past year, and Cale's in his third year. And when they were just wee little guys, Crean and I were still off and on pursuing our own formal education. We were finding that an enriching and invigorating experience. And so I think naturally enough, we had the hope that someday, you know, our kids might do the same. And we did a couple of things that we hoped would help that to be the case. We set about seeing to it that they got the best education we could envision for them in their pre-university years. For us, that meant homeschooling. That's not everybody's choice, I know, but that's the path that we went down. It also meant starting to put some money aside so that even if our ship never came in, which turned out to be a clear view of the future, they could afford to go to university when the time came. That could all sound extremely prescriptive. Like a couple of helicopter parents just predetermining the course of their kids' lives, right? And I want to put that into a wider context because we didn't understand any of those things I just described to be our primary mission as parents. Our first call as parents then and now was to love and accept these people just as they were, just as they are. Yet it was also to work to make their lives better and to do that in some ways that pointed toward the ways that their existence enriched us. To use Rawlins' words again, to have hope for those we love is to give ourselves to their betterment, to be motivated by the idea that their life could be richer. Now let me come back to Mr. Kushner's quote for a moment and my question about it. If God's job is not to make sick people healthy, that's the doctor's job, metaphorically, that's our job. God's job is to make sick people brave. It still leaves outstanding for me this question, so what's my job? Well, growing up, I didn't just learn that the religious answer was to pray that God would make the sick person well. I also learned that you make a casserole and you take it to the house. You go over and help with the chores. You mow their lawn. You drive their kids to stuff because they're not available to whatever. You do stuff that needs to be done. You show up at the hospital, even if communication is impossible, to sit in solidarity with the suffering. Like, you, this is what you do. And some of those courses of action, the way I took away my understanding as a child, anyway, some of those courses of action were understood to be religious. The others were understood to be just what you do. What I've been proposing this morning is that there might be a way to look at hope in the world that brings those two ideas together. That essentially says, and I mean no disrespect for this, in fact, in my mind, I mean something deeply sacred by this, that says that God is in the casserole. That God is in the chores. That God is in the silence. That God is in the uncertainty and the anguish. That hope is not somewhere else, but right here in the midst of the hurly-burly of life, right in the midst of all of that uncertainty. Not some other place, some other time. Right here, right now. I can't say it like Rumi said it. There you go, same idea. I mean that I think that there's a way to practice hope that can move us from, let's use the language we've been using, from an idolatrous perspective that turns us from the world to an iconic one that turns us toward engagement with the world. next week we're going to poke around a bit in the question of meaning and in this deeply problematic idea that everything happens for a reason. Which has kind of been built into, kind of been humming in the background of what I was talking about this morning. I haven't made it explicit, but next week we'll do that. So that should be fun, right? At any rate, I think that's enough to chew on for now. So I'm going to stop talking, and we'll sing together. And then we'll walk out of this and into that. The language is deliberate. Part of what I hope we will increasingly be aware of is that that's a problematic idea, that we walk out of this and into that, that we walk away from what happens here into what happens there, and increasingly begin to understand that it's all here. That the very best of what we can encounter in the richest moments that we might share with another human being happens inside of the same presence as the most horrible things that we might experience as a human being. If we think God is waiting in the wings to make everything better someday, and we can't bring our concept of the divine into the midst of suffering, we are at the very least destined to spend a huge chunk of our life wondering where God went. And it's liable to be the chunk where we're in the most pain. To me, that just feels like a fundamental religious problem. And one which for me, this is a very personal confession. This is not a perspective I'm even asking anyone in the room to toy with. But for me, sometimes that means that I feel like what I need to do in my own life and practice is basically blow up religion as I've experienced it to make room for faith. And then I think about that, you know, those moments with my mom in the casserole, and I think, no, I think this was actually happening. The thing that my heart is hungry for was happening. But the religion in which it was happening wasn't talking about it as part of the whole. It was hiving off these things that I think are meant to be, that need to be, deeply, intrinsically, irrevocably integrated. If we actually want to have a prayer of the possibility of God, of the divine, being present in the full spectrum of the human experience, and not just in some religious quadrant of it, that we then try to carry to other people as a religious exercise. Not a here and a there, just a here. Peace.